I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We're about to have another conversation with our Secretary of the Department of Housing and Community Development here in the state of Maryland, Ray Skinner. Well, Ray, welcome back to the studios once again.
Mark, I'm delighted to be with you, as always.
And I've always been a huge fan on a number of levels in what we do in the state with any number of different kinds of departments with mediation. But now mediation has found its way into the world of foreclosures.
Yes, it has, Mark. As you know, Governor O'Malley has been out front in trying to help people to stave off foreclosure and to stay in their homes. And the latest arrow in our quivers is something called foreclosure mediation. During the last legislative session, the governor proposed and the General Assembly approved a foreclosure mediation law, which allows homeowners to actually sit down face-to-face with a representative from their lender or servicing company and really trying to work out a solution right there on the spot. One of the concerns that we have had in terms of this foreclosure crisis that we still see too many what we refer to as unnecessary foreclosures. And that, what we mean by that is that many homeowners really end up kind of on a dual track. That is, one portion of their lender or servicing company is working with them to modify the loan, and another is working to push them into foreclosure, another portion of the company. And they don't talk, and more often than not, people end up in foreclosure before the modification can go through. So what we're trying to do is through this foreclosure mediation is to make sure that that doesn't happen, or in fact it's limited. So the foreclosure mediation law requires lenders to really certify that they have exhausted all loss mitigation options before they can actually file for foreclosure. And it gives the homeowner the right to request mediation, again, where they would sit down with a representative from their lender or servicer and a neutral third party and really try to work out some kind of settlement that all parties can agree to right there. And this law really builds on the reforms that Governor O'Malley had put in place over the last couple of years, where we gave people more time in terms of how long it took for companies to actually foreclose, gave them a right to more notice, and so forth. The other key thing about the foreclosure mediation law is that it now requires a lender to pay a fee when they file for foreclosure. And this is the first time that has happened in the state of Maryland.
And that fee helps fund this mediation program.
Absolutely. The fee goes into what's called the Maryland Housing Counseling Fund, actually. And these funds are used to one, to pay for the cost of the mediation, but also to help pay for the cost of our network of housing counseling agencies who will work with the homeowner through this process. The law, the foreclosure mediation law, went into effect July 1st. So only foreclosures that were filed after July 1st, 2010, after July 1st, 2010, would those homeowners be entitled to this mediation process.
That's fascinating. And I think this is important for people to understand and take advantage of. So if you need it, you call what number?
1-877-462-7555, or you can go to our website at www.mdhope.org.
So don't lose your home. Go mediate.
Yes.
Ray Skinner, thank you once again.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. This week, join us for a trip to Cottingham Farm in Easton, Maryland. Cottingham Farm grows a wide range of organic produce, from heirloom tomatoes to many colors of beets and carrots to a wide variety of greens, live kale, arugula, and tetsoi. Cleo Braver, who owns Cottingham Farm, along with her husband, Alfred Tyler, recently testified in Annapolis in support of new legislation that would affect farmers throughout Maryland. Here she is to explain.
Well, there's a lot of pieces of legislation that really should be of extreme interest to Marylanders, but there's two that were really notable, more notable than others. And one is pending in both the House and the Senate, is a proposal to ban the use of arsenic in chicken feed. And the other is a proposal to ban the use of atrazine, which is an herbicide that's number one use is to kill weeds on feed corn in feed corn fields.
But those were two different.
Yeah, two different bills, two different, you know, but they're related to the industry because, as you know, one of the dominant agricultural models in Maryland is the production of feed corn and feed soy to feed CAFO, confined animal feed operation, chickens. And so apparently it's in the feed that they feed the chicken is arsenic. And there were a lot of, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but there were plenty of scientists and
folks from Center from a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins,
right.
Bloomberg School of Public Health were there.
Yes, people with, you know, really big, impressive names and resumes who know what they're talking about the impact of arsenic on our human health. And about the impact of atrazine on human health. I mean, atrazine's been tied to breast cancer and prostate cancer, to birth defects, and arsenic has serious health consequences.
So the arsenic is about the feed and the chicken.
Yeah, Roxarsone.
The chicken feed.
Right.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
And the atrazine is what we put on the fields to enhance the corn crop.
It's
right?
What they spray in the fields to kill the weeds.
To kill the weeds.
So they can grow the feed corn to feed the chickens. So it's all, you know, it's all one industry. And, you know, I believe as much as the next guy does that, you know, farmers should have the right to farm the way they want to on their land. But I think, you know, I think we, like every other segment of society, have to be, you know, cognizant of the impact of our methods and the product that we ultimately produce on both our neighbors, the consumers who eat the product, and on the environment. And there's some significant consequences on the environment and our health. I mean, it results in serious disease and death. And I'm sympathetic to the corn farmers who are concerned about the economic impact of outlawing atrazine. But even the USDA says it's, you know, it's a 1.19% drop in their productivity in the cornfields if they banned atrazine in this country. A 1.19% drop in productivity. And I think Maryland's health is more important than a 1.19% drop in productivity.
So, and the testimony you gave, you testified in both the hearings that for the arsenic, the bill to take arsenic out of chicken feed and to ban the use of atrazine.
Right.
You testified at both places.
I did. And I did so as a farmer and as a citizen. You know, as I said, I'm not familiar with the science. All I can do is, you know, Google like everybody else does and read some of these reports. I mean, I like to rely on, you know, the folks like, you know, Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future and, you know, it's pretty clear. And, you know, I really think, you know, life doesn't really present us with a whole lot of black and white choices. You know, we're, you know, life is pretty complex and there's a lot of things that we have to weigh when we make decisions. But I think this is a pretty clear one. I don't think a 1% increase in yield should outweigh the tremendous healthcare costs. I mean, Maryland's got one of the highest healthcare costs in the country and one of the more rapidly escalating healthcare costs in the country. And, you know, we need to start dealing with those costs, and I think attacking some of these issues is one way to deal with it. I mean, aside from the fact that the corn is going into high fructose corn syrup, and you know, it's really contributing to the wave of obesity and diabetes and escalating healthcare costs. I mean, but on top of not being healthy, it's actually presents poisons in our food system.
So the these bills being introduced that you. And many of us testified against them. Baltimore restaurateurs testified against the the arsenic and the chicken feed.
Because their clients are increasingly asking for clean food. They're
right.
Increasingly saying, where does this meat come from? Where does this, you know, this produce come from? And what was put in it? And folks are increasingly become aware that, you know, maybe they can afford to buy organic. Maybe they can afford to pay more attention to the food that they eat because it's causing their families, you know, health consequences.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a little bit, a question of the cost of eating well and what changes that. But I was not at those hearings, so I knew about the hearings and talked to people about the hearings. And I'm curious if you recall what the arguments were for why we have to maintain arsenic in chicken feed. We feed the chickens.
Economic.
At the CAFOs.
It's all economic arguments. And, you know what? I majored in economics. And I get that that's what motivates people. I mean, I get it. I'm not fighting it. I understand. It's basically money and sex motivates people. And, you got to learn to live with human, to work around those issues. But I think if we are really interested in looking at things from an economic point of view, we have to do it from a broader, perspective. And the economic, again, it's the reduced productivity if they can't use this atrazine to kill the weeds. It's a reduced productivity on the arsenic if they, they believe that it contributes to growth. It contributes to, I guess the way they say it is, it contributes to helping battle disease in the birds. What it does is, it's a poison. So I would imagine the animals are a little bit less active and, you'd probably sleep if you were given arsenic too. And so they can now harvest them at 7 weeks, and they're proud of that fact that they can harvest them at 7 weeks. And so if you can harvest them a week early, you are giving them 1 week's less, you're giving them less feed. I think to some extent, I don't know that it's proportional. I'll learn because we're going to have chickens starting next month. We're going to have depastured poultry. But, if you can cut the length of the life of the chicken, you're cutting your costs. And so they're arguing that they can't be competitive if they have to have higher costs of production. And the answer to that is, well, gee whiz. Purdue has finally, thank you, Purdue, has finally stopped using arsenic roxazone in their feed. And so last time I checked, Purdue is one of the more successful chicken growers, integrators, in not just in the Delmarva Peninsula, but in the country. So, that is a fallacious argument. It just doesn't make sense. And let me tell you something. This is really amazing. One of the industry executives on the arsenic bill actually said this. He said it was, quote, morally repugnant for the legislature to consider taking away, a tool of theirs that they use to increase productivity. And I submit to you it's more morally repugnant to poison your neighbor, to have, arsenic end up in the drinking water, to have arsenic be in the meat of the chicken when you eat it. I think that is more morally repugnant than to interfere with the productivity. And I think it's especially a little, disconcerting to hear those productivity arguments when you realize that particularly like the corn farmers, and again, I have nothing against it, policy has been created to incentivize farmers to grow corn because they're paid significant amounts of money to grow corn every year. These folks who grow, a few thousand acres of corn, get federal subsidies of, seven digits. And I'm not counting the pennies.
Individual farmers get seven.
Yeah, the corn farmers can get some of the, you can look, you used to be able to look it up. Some of the farmers get $1 million subsidies annually. And so we're paying them to grow corn. And I kind of think if they lose 1% productivity on the corn because they can't spread a poison anymore, that maybe it's not really unfair to ask them to take that 1% productivity hit, given how much the taxpayer base through the Farm Bill is supporting what they're doing.
And the folks at the Center for Liberal Future and the nurses from the nursing group from the University of Maryland Hospital.
And Maryland Hospitals for Healthy Environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were testifying about the health issues related to how we grow our corn.
Yeah, they're tremendous. There's neurological damage caused by some of these things, and when they spray the atrazine, the science is pretty clear. There's a lot of health consequences of both the atrazine and the arsenic. And the atrazine, it should be banned because it's not just a matter of, well, if the farm next to you is spraying atrazine, you might be exposed. It can travel hundreds of miles in the air when it's sprayed. And it travels into the groundwater. So we're all being exposed to it. Everybody is being exposed to, if you're within a couple hundred miles of where they're using it. And it has has devastating consequences. And I mean, you hear these folks testify about the illnesses in children, and you know, the impact of arsenic builds up, which builds up in your system over the course of your life. You know, the science is clear about what the illnesses are. You know, I mean, the atrazine is made in Switzerland by Syngenta, and it's banned in its country of origin.
In Switzerland.
It is banned in Switzerland. Does that, are there bells ringing here? You know, it's banned in all of Europe.
But they sell it to us to use.
That's correct. And, you know, I used to travel to China. I think I told you that I used to travel to China in the 90s. And, you know, half of the planes were filled with tobacco executives because they could see the writing on the wall, and they wanted to start building their overseas markets. And I'm here to tell you the shoe's on the other foot now. Now things that are made in other places are being used freely here because we're just not ahead of the curve here. We're not, you know, we're relying on the FDA, and we're relying on USDA to take the proper steps. And, you know, they've been very reluctant to do so. Apparently we've been trying to ban atrazine in Maryland for a good 10 years or more. And, you know, we shouldn't be complacent and say, well, gee, I'm sure the, you know, FDA is doing a great job. And, you know, Maryland has more at stake. We have a Chesapeake Bay watershed to protect, which most states do not have. And we are the second highest concentration of atrazine in the country.
The second highest?
Yes. I heard that yesterday from one of the witnesses. And it makes sense.
Where's the first highest? Someplace like Iowa, Nebraska?
Yeah. I thought we were maybe fourth because, right, you know, the number one use of atrazine is American feed corn. And Maryland is the number four producer of feed corn in the country. So I figured, you know, maybe we're the fourth highest concentration of atrazine, but someone said the second. I don't know what the source of that was, but I think you can look it up, the tons that are sprayed. So Maryland should be on the forefront. Mm. I mean, so the feds don't act. Maryland should act because Marylanders have the most to lose. Marylanders, and we have higher than average healthcare costs. So, what's the connectivity? You know, atrazine, it is the number one pesticide in use in the country. Breast cancer is the number one cancer among women in the country. Prostate cancer is the number one cancer among men in the country. And atrazine is, there's a causal relationship between atrazine and breast cancer and prostate cancer. So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised at these outcomes. We just shouldn't be surprised. And I just, you know, again, I'm sensitive to the economic issues, but I just think the Marylanders' health and the health of the Bay, where we're finding, you know, fish that have, you know, their amphibians are demasculinized, you know, males have, you know, ovaries and eggs.
The fish we're talking about.
Yeah. And it's at one point in some of the rivers, it's 90% of the bass have duo sex issues. And
hermaphroditic now.
Right. 90%. Now, I mean, wow, I'd be concerned if it was 0.9%, but it's 90%. And that should be a concern to all Marylanders because what's affecting them is affecting us. It is in our drinking water. It is in the air. It's all around us.
Now, when we, as in this conversation we're having now, you have had this testimony a couple of days before this conversation, and this will be being heard by all of you in the following week. So this is winding its way through the committee.
Yes, and we want our policymakers to be enlightened and do the right thing, but I think we need to help them do that. I think we need to show them. I think you should ask your listeners to call their legislators, particularly if they're on the environmental committee in either the House or the Senate, and say, please pass this bill out of the committee.
So it makes it to the floor so it can be debated.
I mean,
this is the House of Delegates you're talking about.
The House of Delegates, right, and the Senate,
the
both
in Annapolis. The
Environmental
Matters Committee, which is chaired by Delegate Maggie McIntosh from Baltimore City.
That's correct.
Right.
And the Senate is chaired by Conway.
From?
Joan Carter Conway.
Carter Conway from Baltimore.
Right. And, you know, I don't have, you know, a legislator on those committees, but I, you know, you still... You don't realize. I mean, I've had Senator Cardin say, you know, if five citizens call him on something, he's going to pay attention. It really doesn't take a lot. And it's not enough for us to sit in our living rooms and talk about it. Just pick the telephone up and call your legislator. There's a great little website you can go to, mlis.state.md.us. And it's great. You can actually plug in the word arsenic and read the bill. It's a one-page bill. That's another reason it should be passed. It's only one page. Same with the atrazine bill. It's a one-page bill. But it lets you click on, if you don't know who your representatives are, you know, or your district, just it gives you tools to figure out who your representatives are, either by the name or by district. And there's a map where you can figure out what your district is, I believe. And just, you know, send them an email. It shows the email. Just click on, and if your computer lets you do that, or, you know, close it out and go to your email and send them an email, or pick up the phone and just leave a message. You have no idea what power you have as a citizen to help move the debate. And right now, on the other side, is what's testifying is lobbyists, you know, who are paid to represent these industries. And they need to hear from the other side, people who are concerned about their family's health.
Right. Because lobbyists are there every day talking to the legislators mm-hmm. about why this bill should be the way they want it to be. And it's not just an Eastern Shore issue or a Delmarva issue. I mean, this is, if you live in Baltimore City, let's say,
right.
You're surrounded by Baltimore County cornfields
mm-hmm.
that also use atrazine.
That's right.
I mean, the chicken farms may be on the Eastern Shore, but
right.
the cornfields are across the state.
Absolutely.
So into your groundwater mm-hmm. goes the atrazine, whether you live in Baltimore City or live in Easton.
And they're saying that they've actually, you know, they found atrazine in the groundwater in wells in at least four states. I'm convinced Maryland is that it's there.
You're testing for it in your wells.
Yeah, I'm actually right? happen to be building a new well on my property right now because of some sodium issues I didn't run the atrazine test yet, though, because we don't have a good enough well, so we're going to do another test well. But I will test for atrazine. I will test for arsenic.
But again, what you said to me earlier was interesting, and I think this has to do with how difficult it is for people to get some things done. You said to make the test on this new well you're building on mm-hmm. your farm mm-hmm. for atrazine, you had to spend $450.
Yeah, this one lab charges $470
to test. And that's a lot of money for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
If you wanted to test, if you had a well on your property and you just have to live, then that's how you get your water.
Right.
That's a lot of money for a regular working person to pay.
Well, absolutely. I mean, number one, most people don't know to test for it. And number two, if you did, you would be dissuaded by that charge. As a matter of fact, I took the bottle over but then didn't run the test because I thought, well, I mean, I was curious at that point. But when I find a depth of the water that's good for all the other reasons, sodium, bicarbonate, and all that, then I will test for the arsenic and atrazine as well before we close the well and you know, seal it and start using it. For sure, I will test. I was curious about what it was at that rate, but that depth. But, you know, I wasn't $470 curious. But even of more concern, I think the testing companies, you know, there's no formal procedure.
Because it's never been done. They don't know about it, right?
Well, they do. In fact,
they do know about it.
The guy I talked to, who's over in the Eastern Shore, who does tests, has said that, you know, they have found out atrazine. Not many people ask for it, but they have found it. And, you know, it's here. It's present. I think the safe stand limit is like 3 parts per billion. I don't know what the amount was, but limits – amounts in excess of that safe limit have been found in at least 4 states. And it's, you know, if we're the number 2 user, I got to think that we're one of them. And
well, if we're number 2 user, if that in fact is correct, and I have no reason to doubt a place like Center for Liberal Future and other places saying that.
Well, it's 2 or 4. I mean,
Yeah. And that our corn is grown on the Eastern Shore, Baltimore County, Frederick,
mm-hmm.
in very specific zones, so it's very concentrated.
Right.
You know, that's it's not grown in Silver Spring.
Right, right, right.
So wherever it is, it's concentrated, that's a lot.
Yeah, I can't remember the numbers. The amount of, you know, of pounds or tons is amazing every year that is sprayed. It's huge. And it's it should be of grave concern. And I started to say, I lost my train of thought, but the well testing guy, you know, there's no formal procedure. You know, when he does start finding things like arsenic, when they do start finding things like atrazine, when they, you know, when people do test, there's no formal procedure to communicate those findings to the state. So, you know, we're not really looking for this information, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I think when we start looking for it, I think we're going to be, surprised by what we find. But again, you know, do you have to have perfect knowledge? I mean, no, I think we know enough. You know, we know enough. There's a very small price that, a group is going to pay by banning it. And it ought to be done.
One of the things you said earlier, before we start taking a little walk around your farm, one of the things you said earlier was that, you know, you don't begrudge any farmer the way they farm the land because what they have to do to survive as farmers.
Sure.
At the same time, you also have, from our early conversations, it seems anyway, that you have a different vision of what agriculture could be in this community. So the farmers who now have to make their living growing chickens or corn in the way they do to survive, you think there's a different way to do this and that you have a different vision of what you think agriculture could be in community.
And there are, in fact, some, and I've talked to some, you know, one in Maryland and one in Delaware, that have moved from the confined animal feed operation chickens, where they're growing for an integrator like a Purdue, a Tyson, and an Allen. You know, they're subject, that, you know, they're told this is the feed you have to give them, you know, You know the only thing you own is the waste of the chicken, and it's harsh conditions, and they have to put a lot of capital up for these houses, and they're, you know, subject to all these, you know, restrictions for the integrators, and, you know, I don't know how remunerative it is for them. I'm not privy to the economics, but there are folks who have said, you know what, I've had it. I don't feel well when I go into the chicken house. We're not healthy. I want to change the way I'm doing this. And they're changing and they're starting to do pastured poultry where they either use these movable pens or they put them in paddocks or, you know, there's a number of ways to do it. Or eggmobiles for the layers where they're starting to raise chickens in a more natural way. It's much less stressful for the animal. So they don't have to give them antibiotics to survive the harsh living conditions. I mean, that's the other, you know, problem, one of the other really serious problems. And there's a movement afoot to try to ban the use of non-therapeutic doses of antibiotics to the chickens. You know, you know that when you use antibiotics, you have to take it for the full 14-day course, and you can't stop before it's done, and you can't take it for 20. You know, these are basically laboratories for creating antibiotic resistant bacteria, and they've done remarkably well at doing precisely that. And there's been studies at Hopkins, Dr. Ellen Silberkeld, mm-hmm. who's done studies on you know, MRSA, and you know, I know someone who died of MRSA, an antibiotic resistant bacteria in Talbot County. So you've got that issue as well. So if the chickens are brought or raised in a more natural environment and, you know, they keep all their body parts, they're not declawed and de-beaked and, you know, they're fed grain, yes, but they're also outside eating the slugs and the bugs and the insects that they're supposed to eat, and they're in the sunshine, so they're getting vitamin D. And, you know, the eggs of chickens that are raised like this are much healthier, have higher levels of vitamin D and tocopherols, higher levels of the good cholesterol, much lower levels of the bad cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So it's a much healthier product that you're going to eat. So one egg from a CAFO chicken is completely different than an egg from a pastured chicken. So some of these folks are going to pasture poultry and they're realizing, you know what, you know, they can get more money for the eggs, they can get more money for the chickens because the cost structure is higher. You know, it costs more to, you know, especially if you're organic and you're using organic feed, it's twice as expensive as non-organic. But more and more people, to the extent people are realizing that, you know, they'll be healthier if they eat this food rather than the CAFO chickens, you know, they're starting to ask for these products to the extent that we're going to start doing them ourselves here. We're going to start doing pastured broilers and layers here as well on our farm. But some are moving to this old-fashioned way of growing chickens and this old-fashioned way of producing eggs. Is it large scale? No, of course not. Is it better for the environment? Yes. Is it healthier for the people who eat the food? Yes. Is it more humane for the animals? Yes. You know, can this kind of farming, you know, feed Maryland? Absolutely. Because this kind of farming is not land intensive. So it doesn't take a lot of land to grow. I mean, I'm growing for Whole Foods and a 4-day a week market and local restaurants on 4 acres. Last year I grew on 2 acres of land, my produce. It's not labor intensive. It's not land intensive.
You have 100 family CSA that you're growing vegetables for.
We're going to have 100 family CSA, yes. And, you know, but it is labor intensive, so it creates jobs. I mean, I'm not going to feel bad about that, creating good jobs for people who want to be part of a kind of a transformative food business.
One of the things that in these conversations that we'll be having a great deal more of over the course of the year that we have had with farmers from all different parts of the industry, mm-hmm. some organic and some who worked in CAFOs or close people who worked in CAFOs, in conversations at table, is that there's always seems to be an impasse when you talk about how do you get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you create a system that allows that change to happen without the bottom falling out while you're doing it and being able to grow enough that is affordable for regular working people? People could argue that 70 to 90% of Americans at this point can't afford the food you're talking about.
Right. Well, there's one simple solution, actually, and that is, I agree. I mean, they've got so much capital invested in a corn planter, and there's only one thing you can do with a corn planter, that's plant corn. They've got so many hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in these large chicken houses, and maybe there is something we could do with those. But, what has to happen is we've got to shift some of the funding, the billions of dollars of taxpayer money every year that goes into the farm bill in corn subsidies, to start shifting some of that in significant, more significant portions than we have. It's been very, very small amounts of money that go toward organic, but shifting it toward these more sustainable, healthier organic systems of production that will produce healthier food for people. I mean, if you took a third of those, monies and shifted it to incentivizing these conversions and incentivizing this new old-fashioned kind of farming, you're there.
Some people like Wayne Gilchrist argue that the Eastern Shore, Delmarva as a whole, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, could become the breadbasket for the Mid-Atlantic region, could become the breadbasket for America from northern North Carolina to New York if it was done in a certain way.
I agree that we have the capability to do that. Whether it's wise to make that big of a breadbasket, I question seriously. I mean, to me, the notion of what we need is we need a food integration for a food processing facility. We need to have these mobile processing units that go around to the different farms and process the large animals and the small animals. We need to have a facility that receives the produce, that washes it, that packages the meat, that labels it, that sells it on a retail basis and then on a wholesale basis within a reasonable food jet. I think a reasonable food jet is 100 miles. Maybe it starts out a little bit larger than that. And
some people would argue it's a little farther than that, but that's up for discussion and argument, I think.
But then we could have a number of these. So then instead of growing this business so that it's behemoth and we're exporting to China, which is what kind of got us where we are, the bulk of our food is coming from California and Florida, and it's coming from Mexico and Canada. The average food mile traveled is 1,200 miles. For fresh produce on your plate, it's 1,500 miles. There's a lot wrong with this picture because a lot of fuel costs goes into transporting food, back and forth. We should have these regional food production facilities that service a much more reasonable food shed, whether it's 100 or 200 miles, whatever. But clearly, it ought to happen here before it happens anywhere else because we're in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, which we want to protect, and because we are within an overnight drive of so many metropolitan centers. But if you started out by creating a food facility and a food system that serviced the Eastern Shore, Baltimore, Annapolis, Washington, Wilmington, Philly, that's a lot. Most parts of the country don't have those ready markets available. So it ought to happen here. There's just no hindrances for it happening here. I mean, it would be very easy to do here, and I think it would have huge ramifications on our healthcare costs in Maryland and. You're creating an economy in Maryland where we're paying Marylanders to grow our food. How many billions of dollars do Marylanders spend on food every year? I don't know that number, it's a lot.
If you look at it's the public school systems alone in the state of Maryland
mm-hmm.
spend close to $1 billion a year, $900 million a year, on purchasing food, most of which is prepackaged and comes from elsewhere.
Right,
but that's
That's alone. This is clearly a multi-billion-dollar industry that is waiting to be created on the Eastern Shore, and there are plenty of people who are interested in doing what I've started to do on my farm and doing it on their farms that just don't have the wherewithal to do it, or the time, or the knowledge to manage animals, or to put up new wells or fences, or package produce for Whole Foods. It's just something that's ready to happen, and I think our administration is interested in seeing it happen.
And it's the two things you mentioned. There are two ideas you mentioned that are also not talked about very much, which is the question of food processing, mm-hmm. how you get it from the farm to the table,
right.
And whether it's the packaging and of vegetables and fruits that are harvested, or for the omnivores in the world. How you package the chickens and the meat and whatever else people are going to have, and the larger question of how you think about it as a food system rather than just the stuff you buy.
Well, clearly there needs to be this infrastructure. This is the infrastructure of the 21st century, like the highways were the infrastructure of the 1950s. I mean, this is it. Example, packaging, I don't know what the averages are. I think it's 1%, 2%, of your gross product in the food industry on packaging. Mine's much higher than that because I've got to pay, I just got some bags, to put my 1 pound produce bag, produce in. And it was, fully 20% of the bag price to ship it to me from Maryland. it's really hard to live with cost structure like that. But if we had an integrated facility where, I'm not just buying bags for Cunningham Farms produce, there's an organization, that should probably be an L3C, organization that's motivated by creating the structure for the community rather than by profit margin, that's going to create, going to be buying these bags for, 27 farms, not just one farm. It's going to be driving my produce, not just Cunningham Farms produce to Washington, where I have, some clients, but it's going to be driving 50 people's produce to Washington. Where you have these shared infrastructure costs, that is going to help to lower the cost. But right now it's just small farms doing it on their own, paying very high proportions of their revenue to these costs that can be aggregated and reduced significantly. What I'm saying is it's got to be aggregated in some way. I don't want to build another industrial agriculture, structure. We've already done that. It's gotten us into a lot of trouble. The model is much smaller than that. It's bigger than me, and it's smaller than that. It's a regional, facility that would be bearing these costs.
And as farmers always tell me that there are no processing plants in the state they can even use.
But animal processing. Absolutely. They go to Delaware.
Pennsylvania.
But Maryland has now got a great new program. I'm actually going to training on the 16th. I think tomorrow is the first training. A new program where you can self-certify yourself and your farm facility to slaughter rabbits and chickens. So people can do it on farm and be able to sell their chickens that they've slaughtered at the farmer's market to a restaurant, as long as it's within the state of Maryland. That's a new program. So that's going to advance, us greatly. You still can't sell across state lines, obviously, but that will help. But there's still a lot of people who want to grow chickens that don't want to process them. So if this, if we could have, a mobile processing unit, it's a $300,000 unit that can go from farm to farm to process, several hundred chickens or 1,000 or whatever the number is that is at a particular farm. So the people can be involved in the growing of it, and then a team comes in and does the processing on a scheduled basis. This is a part of the infrastructure that we need in the state of Maryland, because there's plenty of people who want to participate, but not necessarily on the slaughter end.
Well, I think we've gone from legislator to legislature to what kind of farming we could have. Maybe you should now take a walk around your farm and see what we got.
All right.
Yep. Let's do that. You're listening to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner, and that was Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farm in Talbot County. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more from Cottingham Farm. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information,
www.mecu.com.
Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. We're going to continue our visit to Cottingham Farm in Eastern Maryland. In the next segment, owner Cleo Braver took us out to her fields, where she uses unheated greenhouses to extend the growing season for a variety of crops and for a variety of reasons.
We had a torrential rains here. That's the problem. The rains are increasingly, you know, you occasionally have drought and then torrential rains, you know, which is another reason
why the patterns is changing so dramatically.
Very dramatically. You know, I know farmers who've grown, you know, squash for 30 years who've never had squash rot, you know, who just didn't have any of their harvest last fall because of the heavy rains. So I think you're going to be seeing more and more of these tunnels that protect the soil against those torrential.
So this not only helps grow with maybe a longer season and grow more.
Oh, definitely. That's what it started out as.
But it's also being forced by the climate change to kind of move to a different style of farming.
Yes.
This was survive.
Right. No, absolutely. This was definitely the notion was season extension for these unheated tunnels. It's just to extend the season. So on the beginning end and the late end, so you can get things in the ground sooner than you otherwise would. So, for instance, you know, you wouldn't plant tomatoes here till May 1st, May 10th, depending on how conservative you are. We'll plant the tomatoes in here March 15th to March 22nd. So even though it's only an ambient temperature is only like 4 or 5 degrees warmer than outside, the soil temperature is much warmer. So we're going to come out here in 2 weeks with our tomatoes. So that gets me a five, six week, you know, head start on tomatoes. And
so I can have my tomatoes
more than a little bit. Honey, I will make my first delivery of tomatoes the very first week of May.
Oh.
So May 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. May 5th is our first CSA drop-off in Easton. And on May 5th, our CSA folks will be eating their first tomatoes. It's likely to be just the determinates, but there's some great determinate tomatoes now, like the little yellow taxi tomato and black seaman is a fabulous, smoky, rich-tasting tomato. And then we have some reds like Celets and Moscovitz. So it'll be the early determinates and the cherries. The cherries are pretty fast from transplant. You know, it's like, you know, some of them are like 52 days to 60 days for the cherries. So, you know, people will have a pint of cherry tomatoes and a pound of heirloom, and they're all heirlooms of large tomatoes in their CSA baskets on May 5th.
Hmm. So, again, if my mind always comes back to the earlier questions I always ask, I'm really interested in how things potentially can transform, or if they could actually transform in our society and on the peninsula here. And I'm just looking at these houses that you can move, and I'm thinking about farmers who love their land and are struggling to make ends meet, whether they work for CAFOs or whether they are growing these mounds of industrial corn for sugar sweeteners, for sweeteners or for the industrial use. And if they could make a living, if their lives were transformed to something like this, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, if this was like somebody's land where dozens of these growing vegetables.
Absolutely, they could. I mean, I really, really
truly believe that.
Look, you know, the value of the feed corn, I mean, it's low value feed corn. It's not very high value. The value of the sustainably produced or organic, you know, vegetables is very high. And that's without considering what the social value is of those products. And, the value of the feed corn is low, even without considering the additional externalized environmental and health costs of those products. So it's really, those are really low value products. And I don't mean to say that in a disparaging way. I mean, I'm talking absolute, you know, what is the value per pound of this? And, you know, you get far more of a higher price, and it's not price gouging. It reflects the higher cost of production. You get a higher cost for an organic chicken than you do for a CAFO chicken. They're two completely different objects. They're not fungible commodities. They're two completely different objects. And no, they could. And I think a lot of the CAFO farmers, the chicken farmers, you know, I saw some of them testify at the hearings this past week. I mean, they are frightened, you know, and justifiably so. But I can't help but think that they would
like others that I have talked to who have done it, would love to be a part of this, would love to know that they're building the tilth of their soil rather than breaking it down, that they're, you know, creating a product that's got a very high value in the marketplace because more and more Americans want to feed their families healthy food. That, you know, they're going to be working closer, you know, with in the dirt, in the soil. You know, you're releasing, you know, ladybugs to kill the aphids, you eat the aphids. You're not spraying a pesticide that's going to harm the soil. You know, what I'm asking to see, what I'm hoping to see here is, you know, I haven't invented this. These farmers' parents and grandparents were doing this kind of farming. I mean, yeah, they didn't have these, you know, double 6 mil layer plastic, you know, high tunnels. You know, that's a new invention. Maybe not. And there were cold frames and things like that. But, you know, this is the traditional farming. And what I think a lot of us want to see is that return to traditional farming because, you know, as we all lead more and more unsustainable lives, I mean, this is a return to what's good for the planet. It's good for the earth. It builds up the tilth of the soil, which is very depleted and increasingly reliant on synthetic fertilizers to produce anything. And it produces a product that, my goodness, it's delicious. I mean, we haven't even talked about that. I mean, it's, you know, it's really good food. And people like eat your carrots and go, why are your carrots so sweet? You know, what I want is to see more and more folks go back to the farming that their parents and their grandparents did. And I think they would love it. I think they would love it. The folks I've talked to who have made the change.
Because farmers love the land. They love the farm.
Of course they do. Of course they do.
They've been in the family for hundreds of years. This is their, yeah. This is, their roots are here. They're buried here.
That's right. They, you know, they don't want to hurt the environment. They've just, you know, American public policy has encouraged the wrong thing. You know, we've basically said, do it. You know, we're going to pay you to do this. And so, you know, who would have dreamt that maybe that wasn't the best thing to do? I mean, you know, you assume our policies are being set in ways that are going to be better for us. And I know it had its place at one time, but, you know, I think the plethora of corn based on the subsidies for corn and corn is in tens of thousands of products on the grocery store shelves. I mean, it's corn plus something else to make an emulsifier and corn plus something else to make a stabilizer and corn plus something else to make an anti-caking agent and corn plus something else to make a, you know, I mean, the categories of these different additives, food additives are astonishing. And you just go on the FDA website. I mean, you know, the FDA's attitude is, you know, the American diet is relying on things like dyes. You know, without dye, we wouldn't have brown cola. Well, I submit to you, most Americans would rather drink drinks that don't have dye in it, would rather not need their food to have an artificial agent that creates that mouth feel of food, you know, or flavor-enhancing agents to create, you know, some reminder that you are eating food. I mean, you know, and all these additives were approved by the FDA on the basis that there was very small intake of these additives. And in fact, the intake is far greater than what the FDA originally estimated because it's in so many products. You know, you're much better off eating food that comes straight out of the ground or off of a farmer's farm or, you know, an animal that, you know, or produce or fruit or, you know, dairy. You're going to serve your body well by by eating, you know, what I like to call real food.
This is made me think this, that what we're standing in now, that you could this could be translated into farms across the country. I mean, all kinds of.
Oh yeah, urban farming. There's no reason why it can't be done. It is being done in cities. You read all these great articles about these wonderful people who are doing urban farming. You know, a lot of folks are doing it on a very small scale basis. But there's nothing to aggregate them or pull them together or encourage them or create the infrastructure that they need to be able to lower their cost structure. Mm-hmm. Lots of people want this food. Hospitals want it. Prisons want it. Schools want it. Markets want it. There's an incredible demand for this kind of food. And there's a lot of people interested in it. We just need a little bit of infrastructure to help make it happen. And there's just no better place for it to happen than here. And, you know, it doesn't have to. I'm not saying it has to totally replace what is here, but I'd like to see a little bit more of this kind of farming and see a little bit more of a transition. And I think the folks who are doing some of the CAFO chickens, you know, they'd be independent too. You know, they're not, they'd be independent from the integrators. They could be calling their own shots and working their own hours and enjoying working in the land.
It may be utopian thinking, but I would say in 25 years of transition, everything could be like this.
It doesn't even take 25 years. We could do it in a year. We could do it in a year.
But the economic and processing and all the other infrastructure is not there yet. It has to be built.
You know what? That could be built. It could be built. And, you know, if I had $3 million in funding, it would be built by the end, certainly by the end of 2012, if not sooner. You know, it's not that, you know, it's not, you know, one of the bigger pieces was a USDA certified animal processing facility, but it's much better to process animals on farm. It's much kinder to the animals. And that can be handled with these mobile processing units. The rest of it, you're building a retail food facility. You're building a place where, you know, food gets accepted and received and graded and sorted and put into boxes and put into plastic bags and labeled and then, you know, put into reefer trucks, refrigerator trucks, and going to Washington and Baltimore and the Eastern Shore and Philadelphia and Wilmington. You know, that is, this is not rocket science. It's not rocket science, and it's not, it doesn't take that much funding to accomplish. But it could have an incredible impact on the producers for lowering their cost structure. I envision this whole integration facility being carried out by a not-for-profit or by an L3C, which is a low-profit limited liability company, you know, who has two goals. Its primary goal is a societal goal to create something of value to the community, and its secondary goal is to make money so that it can pay the people well for the important work that they do. And also maybe subsidize the cost of some of the products so that everybody can afford, you know, clean food. But, you know, that structure that needs to be built. And this is waiting to happen. This little revolution is waiting to happen in the state of Maryland.
We're standing in part of it right here. That was Cleo Braver, owner of Cottingham Farm in Talbot County. That's all the time we have for On Delmarva today. Thanks for tuning in. We welcome your feedback and ideas for upcoming shows, so please send them to comments@ondelmarva.org. On Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Tom Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.